Welcome to Packet Pushers, the data networking podcast, where real-life network engineers gather in the virtual conference room to chat about news, work life, and the next big thing coming to your data center. I am Ethan Banks, your host and network engineer in the trenches, taking a break from the command line to chat with an international cast of technical talent. This is show number 55, recorded on July 27th, 2011, and the topic of the day is questions that you should be asking your cloud provider. So first up from Denmark, Kim Peterson makes his first appearance with the Packet Pushers. Kim, it is great to have you. Would you tell us what you do? And don't forget to mention about a certain five-digit number that you're still getting used to.
Thanks, Ethan. I'm a network engineer in Denmark, working for a consulting agency. I just got my CCIE in routing and switching.
Awesome. So we just did a show a little bit ago where the some guys that just passed the lab talked about their experience a bit. So let's park there for a minute. What did you think of the lab? Was it as hard as you expected?
Well, this was my second attempt, so I pretty much knew what I was going into.
Yeah,
it was you know, fine. I was not as nervous as I was the first time around, so it went out all right.
Yeah, second time's the charm. All right, it is great to have you with us, sir. And our cuddly curmudgeon and designer of data centers is also with us this week, Mr. Greg Farrow, who really needs no introduction to regular listeners of the program. And Mr. Greg, you've been staring at the screens kind of a lot lately, haven't you?
I have. I've been working from home, and I have been on a training course on the Cisco Nexus 7000. I'm skilling up to become a Cisco trainer, no less. And that means I have to sit repetitively through a training course, which is, of course, a great experience and a process of gathering in knowledge and listening to some very smart people talk about products. But the second or third time, it's starting to wear a little thin, yeah, I must say.
Exactly. Oh, man.
Yeah.
Oh, I hear that. Of course, yeah. Also with us, some say she denies the existence of the word unencrypted. And when security auditors need auditing, she's the one they call. And all we know, she's called Mrs. Y. We are glad to have you back this week, Mrs. Y. Thank you for joining us around the virtual conference table. And tell us, what is new in the world of academia?
Well, we're dealing with the fallout from Lion upgrades and all the things that it can't access on our network, like our VPNs. And I've been struggling with, and I know this is crazy, Solaris. I had to build containers and install some legacy FLARs so I could recompile bind for our name servers.
Wow.
And because I'm the only one in networking who knows how to use Solaris or compile or...
So you're doing make files and all that good stuff so you can compile your own binaries to run on... Why, yeah, Solaris still? Just that's what's been there?
Because we have the name servers that I originally built, and I won't tell you what year. But Solaris just runs. And, you know, in a lot of cases, I think in a lot of organizations, you go, well, it's not broken. Why would we upgrade it? It works great.
Oh, man.
And, you know, we need to, you know, there are some new security vulnerabilities that have come out. And I said, well, are you guys going to recompile it?
We don't know how to do that.
So I have a Solaris 10 box, so I had to put legacy FLARs on it. So I had to first create containers and then put the FLARs on it so that I could compile bind that, you know, I could port over to our production name servers.
Wow. Well, before we get into the cloud discussion, let's do a few news items. And Greg, you wrote up an article about Dell buying Force 10 and got a lot of press and people were talking about what you wrote. And of course, there's a lot of opinion out there. What is your take on Dell buying up Force 10?
I think it's a good fit. Force 10 is obviously somebody that we've spoken to at the Tech Field Day that we had last year, and they've got a pretty cool product, and they gave us a pretty cool presentation. They were able to tell us what they had and why they had it, and if you want to find out more, we actually put it in the feed, 6 months ago, 9 months ago, when Peter Waller spoke to us about about what the product is and what it can do. And I thought then that Force 10 was pretty good, and I'd known that Force 10's been around for a very long time. And I do believe that they've got, you know, great products and a great future, but they just haven't been, you know, tacked on to the biggest vendor or, you know, partner with the right people to sort of escape from the sort of the new market. As the market's changing into the current shape, unless you're big enough and bad enough, you're not going to exist in the space. So Dell buying Force 10 seems to work because Dell has a whole bunch of smaller end switches, obviously they have their Dell PowerEdge stuff, which is mainly targeted at the small business stuff. But at the higher end, they've been partnering with Cisco up until when Cisco got into UCS, and then they turned to Juniper to some, and then they also turned to Brocade, and they have partnerships with those. And they've sort of been having a bit of a speed dating process, it looks like, in hindsight, where they've been selling a bit of Juniper, a bit of Brocade, and a bit of Force 10 to all of their customers. And then after a bit of a whirlwind romance, it looks like they've consummated the marriage and brought Force 10.
Which really means they're going to want to sell you the whole stack now, and they're going to be able to do it with the Force 10 filling in the missing pieces in their portfolio.
Yes. Well, more importantly, they've got their own storage. So they have their Equalogic acquisition that they bought some time ago, which caused a bit of a kerfuffle when they did that. And they've done very well pitching that into the mid-size, mid-to-large businesses, mid-to-small-to-large. It's all iSCSI. So having a very high-performance Ethernet switch that they can then say, this is the solution, end-to-end solution, Matt, will work very well for customers who committed to Dell servers, and there's quite a lot of them out there. And the Force 10 product is, you know, in my opinion, top-notch. There's absolutely no reason why it's not as good as Juniper and Cisco provisionally. You know, that maybe there's a few rough edges there that need to be ground off, or there's a bit of, but in terms of capacity and stability and processors and, you know, all the core features that you need, Force 10's a very, very good fit.
Yeah. Now, you did another article this week on software switching. Did you want to mention that?
Yeah. So software switching is it's the du jour topic of the moment, as all of the people, pundits, get around and talk about this thing called software-defined networking and OpenFlow. And, I've been a bit of a booster of it, and we've had a couple of podcasts about it as well, haven't we, where we've talked to different people. The programmers in the world, the people who are all the boosters of VMware, are now all claiming that all networking shall be run in Intel servers, and that actually there's no need for any silicon forwarding. We'll just all do it on white box, you know, Intel-style servers. And we'll have a software program which will forward packets, and, you know, we don't need any of this silicon or anything ever again. And there's one – I've written a couple of articles about why soft switching fails at scale. But the main thing that I wanted to point out was that the proponent who's the booster of this software switching idea, and that is, you know, doing all the forwarding in an Intel server and then just run it over a straight layer 2 and then do all your layer 3 in – is it'll take up one CPU in your server. Now imagine you've got a VMware server. Let's say it's got 8 CPUs, and you've got, you know, 20 vSphere guest OSs, you know, spiking up on that thing. Now let's say that you are then going to do some high-speed networking out of there. So for at the time that your operating system spikes, so let's say that you've got a vSphere, on your vSphere you've got a VMware instance, which is a heavy-duty, heavy-lift. At the very time when that thing is going to peak its CPU utilization up to, say, 80% to heavy thump some data across or do some processing, is the same time that it's going to want to have access to the network. So all of a sudden you're saying, I want CPU to hit a maximum when I'm processing, and now I need another CPU to do network processing at a maximum. So what you've actually done is made your peaks peakier. You've actually doubled up on how big your peak will be. And that's not what you want in a vSphere instance. What you want is a nice, stable, flatline load so that you don't have to over-provision to cope with all the peaks.
Right. Yep, exactly. Yep.
So it's a self-defeating exercise. Now, that said, if the IEEE doesn't pull their fingers out of their butts and let the and dust the moths off the top of the standards that fix this problem and finally push them out the door instead of arguing over what color black ink they're going to put on the front of the paper, they're going to be bypassed by people who just have to write up some software, thump it into a hypervisor or a guest OS, and they are going to be left behind, and we are going to have second-rate networking for the next 20 years. It doesn't take much to write a bit of software, but it does take 5 years to develop a chip. And, you know, without the standards for IEEE 802.1 QB and QBG and QBH, you know, standards ratified, published out the door, and the vendors cutting chips, you know, Cisco's got a pre-standards implementation of that in their VMFX. But if the vendors won't, you know, become industry standard until those standards come out of IEEE, and the IEEE are fumbling around in the dark, you know, tying their shoelaces and arguing over what color corduroy to wear for the next meeting.
Now, that's stereotyping, and that is wrong. You just can't say that about the IEEE, Greg. You apologize right now. oh, man.
Look, I'm being a bit harsh, but I mean, look at what happened with the what was that standard that was supposed to compete with LTE? That one that Intel wanted us to talk about. Why
was that? WiMAX.
WiMAX. That's it. WiMAX. And by the time the IEEE had finally got off the can and said, "Congratulations, we've laid the egg," everybody was deploying LTE. And if you know, if the networking industry, I believe that the vendors need to pull their fingers out and say to the IEEE, "You need to ship this. They need to commit resources to getting these standards done and getting them out the door." Or VMware and Hyper-V are going to pick up all of the networking industry and run with it. Mm. They're going to take all those routers and they're going to put them in the hypervisor, run them on Intel CPUs. It'll be low efficiency and low performance and low bad for everybody, but at least it'll be done and we'll be moving.
Yeah. Now, Mrs. Well, you noticed a story here about the U.S. CERT director gives no reason for his departure. He just up and disappears. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, a lot of the people in the industry are saying that it's connected to all the military contractors that got pwned. So, you know, possibility. Nobody's going to be sure until more information comes out, but Black Hat is next week, so maybe that's where the dirt will come out, hopefully. And where all the hackers are. Yeah, all the hackers are going to be drunk off their butts, so.
And tales will be told, and some of it might even be true.
Yes.
It seems unlikely.
And also, of course, Apple with Lion coming out and all the Apple folk upgrading to that. And there, it's not been without its challenges. I mean, Mrs. Y, you already mentioned challenges in your world with VPN being broken and stuff. And there's also some security problems, too.
Yeah, I mean, we had a problem with the built-in. So the Cisco client, the existing Cisco client, doesn't work 64-bit, and they want you to use AnyConnect, but there's a license fee with the AnyConnect client, and it operates differently. It uses Java. And the option is to use the built-in hidden Cisco VPN client, but we're having problems with that working. On our wireless network, it works wired, but so it prevents us rolling out, you know, Lion to our administrative staff. It's just, you know, and then seconds, I think literally seconds after Lion was released, they're like, "Oh, FireWire hack. Woo! We can turn your battery into a brick." Yeah, I know, it's Lion. It's supposed to be secure, but we can do it.
Man.
So...
And some of that stuff just kind of blows my mind. For example, when a new OS comes out and you think, what is the probably the largest install base of VPN clients out there? Probably Cisco. That's certainly they'd be significant, if not the highest. This is one of the things we want to make sure this works right before we ship this OS. And I guess you can't blame Apple entirely. But at the same time, it's like...
Yes, you can.
You can?
It's the Vatican, I told you. It's like, you know... You know, what are those Dan Brown books about the Da Vinci Code and all that? That's what Apple is like. They don't – I have heard from multiple vendors that they give – you know, they don't really work with other vendors to ensure that these critical enterprise applications and these functions actually work very well. You know, and when a vendor tries to open a case with them, it frequently, you know, hits the bit bucket. So it's – they – I guess they don't care at this point. They're like, we don't have to work that hard to be in the enterprise. Everybody's bringing it in. You know, I mean, at some point they'll lose some market share. Then maybe they'll be a little more, there's going to be some hubris, you know, they're going to be a little more humble about it. But right now it's just, they don't feel like they have to, I guess.
Yeah. Of course, the TSA has come off their high horse a little bit as well. The almighty security folks at the airport have kind of changed their tune now, where they can't quite see how naked you are going through the when you go through the terminal.
Yeah, so much for that second career.
Yeah. And what's the deal on that one? Now they've got some kind of a basically a software math that kind of obscures your physical features as you go.
Well, no, what it does is it instead of it used to actually show you. The physical form, now it gives you an approximation with like the picture I saw was a body with underwear on and stuff, and it didn't look like a real person. So it just says, yeah, we looked but that's not the image we're going to give you. Here's the one, and yet where they might have concealed objects. It was really strange. I mean, I'd like to actually get more information on the software, but, you know.
Yeah, it's not like they're scanning any differently from a fundamental of what the scanning process is actually going to see. I got my hands going wildly.
It's such an HR kind of solution, though. I mean, if you work in a big environment.
Yeah, it's just software that looks at the actual image and says, okay, we're going to paint some pixels here and strategically here, and now it's not so bad. Yeah, kind of
thing.
Yeah,
like what they did to the naked sculptures during the Baroque period in Italy. Yeah. Like they put fig leaves.
Fig leaves on, right, yes. to cover it up and right. Oh, man. Well, what do you say, guys? We ready to talk about questions we should be asking our cloud provider?
Yeah. Sure.
All right. So here's the deal and why we bring this up. A lot of interest is being drummed up in the cloud. Everybody's talking about the cloud, or as Greg would say, the blah, blah cloud, where, hey, let's take our applications and move them to the cloud, or we should be using something in the cloud, or I want to build a private cloud, or, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And cloud is kind of this generic term that means something, and in some context doesn't mean anything. It's just a buzzword that these sales and marketing types throw around. Wikipedia and National Institute of Standards define cloud computing this way: a model for enabling ubiquitous, convenient, on-demand network access to a shared pool of configurable computing resources, such as network, servers, storage, application, and services that can be rapidly provisioned and released with minimum management effort or service provider interaction. I don't know if that helped anybody or not, but...
Well, that's my favorite part, with minimal management effort or service provider interaction. It sort of sets the standards right there.
That's almost the funny part.
Yeah, I know.
Now, Kim, you,
so everything we've done for the last 30 years is wrong. You know, so all those people that we spent putting IT together for the last 30 years are actually, it's a mistake. We take it all back. Sorry.
Oh, Kim, you actually work for a cloud provider, if you will. And what do you think about the last part of that definition there? You know, services that can be rapidly provisioned and released with not a lot of management effort or interaction from you guys, the service provider.
Sure. First off, I'm not the architect behind that, so I don't have the real technical depth in all of it.
So you're saying it's not your fault.
Yeah, basically, I have the same approach to it, that cloud is a buzzword. I do know that when we started out wanting to offer something along the cloud computing style, we basically sat down and read some of these as well. And, you know, the key is with minimal management effort or service provider interaction. We don't provide our customers with the total tool set to manage everything. We do provide some kind of interaction with the client to scale their environments, mainly because we work with them not just as a provider but as a consulting agency as well.
Now, the way I look at cloud services, really a couple of sorts of market tiers that you're really in. One is just, as it strikes me, and I'm trying to simplify this how I'm seeing it, is raw computing power. And this would be something like Amazon EC2. You know, they describe Amazon Elastic Compute Cloud, Amazon EC2, a web service that provides resizable compute capacity in the cloud, designed to make web-scale computing easier for developers. So if you were to leverage this service, you're getting, you know, raw compute power, as opposed to something else like, say, Cisco's WebEx or Gmail on Google or Salesforce.com, which is really providing you an application. They're giving you not just all the compute cycles, but the application that's riding on top of that, and all you're doing is plugging data into this application that lives, quote-unquote, in the cloud. Kim, which are you guys really doing? Are you kind of maybe doing both?
Actually, we are doing both. The term cloud, you know, again, differs from whoever reads it. We're doing something along the lines of we can provide customers with mail and, you know, the basic tools to do their day-to-day job, or we can take their entire infrastructure and move to what in the old days was a colo. So, you know, it depends from everybody. There's no such thing as a one cloud fits all.
Now, you said colo, which is really, I don't want to say old school cloud. That would be the wrong way to put it. I mean, because when I think of a colo, I worked for an internet service provider at one point where the colocation service we provided was a data center. Ping, power, and pipe. That's what we provided. We give you a rack to plug it in and give you the power and plug you up and off you go with your own system and services that you manage. So all you're really leveraging there is location, which I don't know. It's kind of unfair to call that cloud in the sense that cloud to me also has a further definition of there's some redundancy built in there. If some service goes away on the back end, whether it's a network component or a server or storage, the system should keep going. Your application should keep functioning because you've somewhat abstracted your application from the hardware that it's really running on.
Absolutely. Scalability is one of the key things. Not only is it a selling point, but it's also the basis for the entire thing. So our system runs on a complete UCS environment. And of course, it runs VMware, which whatever the guys do to it. So we have some SLAs that, you know, guarantees the customer that if they need another server for whatever purpose, they can get it within this and this amount of time with these requirements. Then there's the data security, backup wise and whatever, which is basically there's several service models for it. The customer can just leave it all to us, and we figure out to do it through different technologies and, you know, offsite and even out on old school tape if the customers want it. So, you know, again, it depends on the customer, but what's their needs and what they're willing to pay for.
I was just thinking about, as you described the services, a whole bunch of questions kind of popped in my head, and I'm guessing Greg and Mrs. Y as well. Mrs. Y, what, as you were listening to Kim describe the services and some of the various offerings, what questions started to percolate through your brain?
I mean, I'm wondering, and this comes up a lot, mostly because this is my emphasis, is security. I'm talking to a lot of vendors now, like I was on the phone with Palo Alto about their virtualization strategy, and they're going to be offering a soft firewall appliance, if you can call what they do a firewall, so that you could take it and put it in a cloud environment. But I'm wondering how much security is a component to a lot of these providers, their offerings. You know, I mean, data leak prevention, intrusion detection, intrusion prevention. I mean, I know that Amazon offers like a sort of a type of host-based firewall. I think they call it a security group. But Kim, what do you do from a security standpoint?
Yeah, Kim, the cloud computing industry is on trial. You're the defendant, so we're gonna beat on you for the entire show. Sorry.
So basically, we got the advantage of not being a huge provider. We basically sat down and said, you know, what are we going to do with this starting out from a blank sheet of paper? We use Citrix extensively for the client that only wants a simple access to something like that. That's their security gateway service. Then we offer, you know, regular VPN connections. If you want to terminate directly to something, you can do it. Then you got the private cloud or whatever it's called, where you can, you know, you have your own site-to-site VPN connections or MPLS, whatever you want to do. We can provide that. You can have your own security appliance. actually hooked into our data center and running service off of that.
I'm sorry, is that like a hardware and or a software security appliance, or do you have restrictions on that?
No, we're pretty flexible. So if you want to come in with your ASA two or three devices or whatever you want to do, we can accommodate that simply because we are, you know, a small provider and, you know, flexible. So again, it all depends on what you want to do and basically what you want to pay for. But we made a, you know, starting point doing a lot of Citrix connections and a lot of site-to-site and a lot of MPLS connections. And, you know, within the range of possibility, we can even do a direct fiber if you're close to us in any shape or form.
Well, one of the things that pops into my head as I think about any of my data going up and living in the cloud is that there's an assumption on my part that my data is going to live in a common set of hardware with other vendors' data that are happen to be using those cloud services as well. In other words, I'm sort of imagining, you know, racks and racks of disk storage and lots of servers, and you know, and my stuff is stored right alongside of six other companies' stuff. And what's to prevent them from getting at my stuff and vice versa? Whether that's at the network layer, whether that's, you know, at the storage layer, how is all of that separation between your tenants typically done?
Again, we're running UCS and we're running, of course, some storage area networks from HP. So they, depending on a customer, again, some say they want their own racks full of storage. Simply because the cloud is, a lot of customers still consider cloud, well, we're not quite sure yet. We don't want our data shared with others, whereas smaller clients can simply choose, okay, we trust you guys to keep it separate. A lot of the networking infrastructure is done, you know, through standard-based private VLANs and whatever that we can, you know, provide for you. Again, a lot of the security stuff is done through ASAs, both good and bad.
So, cheap and cheerful. You know, it's cheap and cheerful.
Yeah, pretty much.
Are you guys leveraging VShield or Altor or any of like the virtualization aware firewalls that hook into the hypervisor?
No, not yet. They're still testing out the performance implementations of all of that. I don't know how far they are in that process.
But it's a road they're going down, that because of the fears about memory leakage and all that kind of stuff with blue pill, red pill. It's something that they're looking at. That's good.
Again, a lot of customers are still pretty wary on this topic, and they ask a lot of tough questions, and we're just going to have to deal with them.
Greg, what's the biggest security question that comes up in your mind when you think about moving your company's intellectual property, if you will, up into a cloud environment?
The security of the staff working in the cloud provider. So if you move, it's not about, there's two things that happen in any security environment, and the cloud's no different. In the British standard for information security, the single greatest risk to data theft or intellectual property theft or data breach is the internal IT staff with a rating of, I think it's 8 out of 10. And 70% of the time is spent making sure that internal staff who have privileged access to the systems are not stealing the data. And quite simply, I don't believe that there are any cloud providers out there who can certify that the staff working for them do not have access to the data. In which case, what are the legal ramifications of doing business with a cloud provider who experiences a breach due to a disgruntled employee? What happens if that person steals your corporate IP, your customer list, your secret information about a product that you're developing? How will you handle that? That's section number one. Section number two, fiduciary responsibility. If a cloud provider goes broke, they will turn it off overnight. So, for example, if you chose even a large size one, they run out of money because of whatever, you know, somebody makes off, there's $100 million accounting fraud. They try to wrap the business up, it doesn't work, and then it gets turned off. So what are you going to do about your data? What's your business going to look like? We know that already today that 90% of companies who suffer a data center failure that do not get it back within 3 days go on to fail within 6 months. If your cloud provider goes under, where is your data? Who owns it? Does the cloud provider own it or do you? And if you had to go to court to get your accounting data back that runs your business to your general ledger and your profit and loss statement, is your business going to survive? Can you afford to be giving that to somebody? If you take your development team and they're hosting all of their code development on a cloud system, and that cloud, let's say you've spent 2 years with a bunch of developers using, say, an Amazon virtual guest instance, and the final product is reaching the end, and something goes wrong, and Amazon stops working. Who then owns the code that's sitting on the servers at Amazon that have now been powered off? And what happens to your business if you lose it?
What about subpoenas? I mean, that was an issue. I saw that, and I was going over the Cloud Security Alliance stuff, and so the FBI comes in. You know, we're going to respond differently than a cloud provider might respond to the FBI.
Yes. So that's right. The FBI went in and took out a bunch of servers, switched off a rack, and took it away.
Right.
In this case, this is the one of that data center in America. They took the servers away but didn't realize there was no hard drives in the servers. It was all in a storage array out the back.
Whoops.
I missed that part of the story.
That's what good. It turned out. Long after the hoo-ha died down, the actual final upshot was they took the servers, took the whole rack of servers because they didn't know what it was. But the servers are actually diskless boot. Over in the back, there was a storage array on the other end of a NAS where the actual hard drive, the actual data was.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
Go Gadget Arms. I guess there's also one other issue that I want to point out is that if you I've highlighted a bunch of process issues, legal compliance, exit. You know, don't look at the glory of getting into your cloud contract. Look at the glory of getting the hell out of it. It's like a business relationship when you get into partnership with people. They tell you, don't worry about, the thing to work out when you're actually getting into a business relationship is negotiating what's going to happen if it goes wrong. Having a contract is not about negotiating the deal of the contract that you're trying to set up. It's negotiating what happens when it goes wrong, because if the contract goes wrong, you have to come out of it clean for both parties so it doesn't damage you and your business. And this is the issue which clouds cannot answer. There are no cloud is taking legal culpability for failure to deliver a service. How much money was lost when Amazon flipped up their data center? And how much money did they pay out to companies for lost earnings and lost revenue?
So you know there was stuff lost, but nothing made the press that they've been taken to court yet about it.
That's right. You can't, because the conditions – and Amazon's big enough to fight that in court. I mean, it's like any IT failure. So there's been any number of gross IT failures across the world. Look at the NHS contract where they let – in the UK where they let billions of dollars worth of IT. And out of the 9 companies who were awarded it, 7 of them have gone broke in delivering it, walked away from, gone broke, handed it over to. And there's only 2 left, and they're only now delivering up to 30% of the initial contract. Who got sued? How much money got back? Was it the billions that was invested? No, it wasn't. Nobody. You know, the reality is that by giving the problem away to somebody else hasn't solved the problem. You've still got the problem of running IT.
Yeah, and you've pushed it a layer further away from you, which could make it more difficult for you to resolve the issue.
I mean, plus I love the Cloud Security Alliance's top threat list. And they had one that I hadn't even thought of, where they said, it's like that old, your parents always tell you, you're judged by the company you keep. Well, if you go with a cloud provider who happens to host some botnets and, spam, then your traffic get blocked because of them. So your business is at risk because of who you're associated with. And, how often do you think about that with, a cloud provider?
Yeah, you might not think that you're hosting your noble and above board and completely legitimate business right next to some guy in an Eastern Bloc country who's spamming the whole planet and is hated, right? And then you get taken out because the world decides they don't like that guy.
Yeah, they're the, you know, you're on the same AS, you're on the same IP space, and so they get blocked, and you get blocked, and you're trying to figure out what's going on.
So to address some of the issues, a lot of our customers actually want our financial records before they go into any sort of arrangement with us, simply to make sure that, you know, they've done everything they could in order to make sure that we're still here in a year or two. So that happens quite often, and that's perfectly fine. Second of all, again, since we're not, you know, Amazon, we have a customer relationship, so we don't accept any Eastern European countries or whatever hosting anything like that. But of course, that is a concern.
But to speak to that, I mean, some big ISPs will do that because there's money in it, so they won't be as selective about their clientele necessarily. Now, I worked for an ISP that actually was quite picky about it, where, you know, if they were doing anything that could that tended towards those sorts of activities, no, they would terminate the relationship with those folks. But other ISPs, man, they can make a pile of cash doing that. You want to host a bunch of spam servers in our data centers? Okay, just keep writing the checks.
Yeah, so, what happens if they get DOSed? They get DOSed and then you get DOSed. I mean, what do you do about that? You start to go down that road, and where does it end?
Absolutely. That's one of the things that we're going to, you know, address in the coming months and years. What are you going to do about issues like that? Because certainly you need to have some kind of arrangement with higher level ISPs in order to do something. Second of all, if I can return to the previous one about customers getting their data back out if they don't like doing business with us, that's actually stated in the SLAs. Both if they have equipment, they can come and get it within a certain amount of time. We are obligated to provide them with some sort of media with all the data, all the service, VMware service, whatever, within a certain amount of time again. So that's part of it as well. Plus, that's a big selling point again.
So written right into their contract with the customers, you say if they want out of this contract, they can terminate it with a certain amount of notice, and then within, you know, time frame X, we will return all of their data back to them. It's explicitly right there in the contract?
Yes, it is. Yeah. And as Greg mentioned, that's the customers are aware of this, and it's a concern of theirs, and having it addressed explicitly helps out a lot for both parties.
It all works right the way up until the receiver walks in, and when the receiver gets a hold of your company, you own nothing. Everything that belongs inside of your company is an asset for the receiver, and all those contracts are declared null and void.
Again, fortunately, I'm not a lawyer.
That's the worst case scenario, though, Greg.
Yeah.
But you don't want to send the company under.
Right? In a lot of ways, Greg's right. You got to think about worst case scenarios.
Yeah.
Right? Until that issue is addressed, the cloud is untrustable. Right. The answer is the receiver does not have the right to your data. Now, in which countries is that true? And for which countries is your data actually in? So, for example, if you take Google, for example, which is probably the most extreme case of a cloud, Google Mail, exactly which data center does your mail reside in? Is it in the UK? Is it in America? Is it in China? Is it in the Cocos Islands?
Because in theory, it could be anywhere.
Right.
In fact, it is anywhere. It is in several data centers worldwide. They actually shard the data into multiple places.
Well, you can ask for – we asked for to keep all our data in the U.S. That was one of the provisions of the agreement, and not just for geographic, so that we would have less latency, but specifically, I think legally, that's what we wanted to be protected by having everything in the U.S.
I can imagine certain scenarios where legally you might be obligated to keep all your data resident in the United States as well. So there would have to be some provisions for that.
Yes. I mean, and that's only the start of it. Now, let's take, for example, you move all of your company's accounting off into some cloud-hosted data system over there, right? So now, what is your cost for maintaining a connection to the cloud system? How many companies are now investing in dual redundant internet connections with SLAs on the internet connection to guarantee access to the cloud system?
Not only that, presumably, possibly some sort of a private connection to backfill your data warehouse, something like that, you may wish to have private.
Right. And what's this WAN acceleration for cloud access too, as well, I've seen?
Yep. That's right. I did a project a couple of years back where we looked at putting something in the cloud. And by the time we'd priced up the cloud system, which was 40% more expensive than the internal cost in terms of rent of running, so it was actually cheaper to run it internally than it was externally. And by the time we bought the additional extranet, the internet bandwidth, because we needed to double the internet capacity to allow for transfers of data to and from, so all the data upload, and then once the data was uploaded, we needed to have extra bandwidth to access it. And then the cloud provider recommended that we put in accelerators to further improve the response time for the system. And, you know, by the time we'd done that, it was it wasn't easy. You know, it wasn't better.
Begs the question, under what circumstances does it even make sense? Why do you as a business say, I want to put X in the cloud, whether that's mail or Salesforce.com, or when does it make sense to do that and when doesn't it?
I can tell you from our standpoint, I mean, it made sense with mail because it was an economy of scale in terms of storage for mail. And it was mostly student and faculty.
Right. That, you're presumably dealing with thousands of accounts that have a lot of turnover.
Right, and they wanted so much storage, and the question would always be, you know, we were providing, I think, at the time, maybe 50 to 200 megs of storage, and they were saying, but Google gives me this. I'm like, well, maybe we should go with Google then. You know, and in that situation, your expectations for mail performance aren't the same as, say, you know, if we hosted, you know, Google Docs or something out externally. I mean, your expectations aren't that high because it's store and forward, right? You know, but you don't know. You don't know what they're doing in terms of security. You don't know, for example, I don't know what mail applications they're running. I don't know if they're patched.
So let's move away from the security discussion. Let's talk about what happens when a cloud fails. And when let's use the Amazon one. They had a failure that was cumulatively bad. So when their data center failed, they had thousands of customers who could not get any information about the outcome. So what you actually had was Amazon internally trying to fix the problem, and they had no way of having any resources to feed back to the customers what's actually happened. Because there's no way they could actually have a call center or that many people on standby to say, we're having a problem, we're working on it. So if we start talking about super scale data centers, like if Gmail goes down, like imagine if Google Mail failed and they had a systemic collapse worldwide, what would happen?
I would be very upset.
Yes. Now, if it goes down for half an hour, nobody cares, right? If it goes down for 4 hours, people are going to have a panic. But if it goes down for a day, how much global commerce would be lost? If you have a cloud system goes down and there's 10,000 customers hosted in that cloud, how, as a customer, are you going to find out that there's a problem and what's going on?
Now, in the Amazon scenario,
they do everything automated. They don't do anything with people. They have no human response capacity. And, you know, what are they going to do to respond to that failure to say that, here's your data now? What's your recovery plan if your cloud fails?
I believe one of the ultimate responses that Amazon came up with was, well, these people that were taken offline during our failure, they were not leveraging our fully resilient service. They were not paying to have that extra tier of service that would have kept them up. Other customers that were impacted by this data center weren't impacted as badly because they were paying for the extra tier of service. So, you know, to speak to that, it seems like Amazon had that answer.
And that's the buyer beware portion. That's where you've got to do that due diligence, and you are not you don't get to relax because you went to the cloud. Oh, it's in the cloud. It's almost more work to some degree because you've got to really look at those terms of service and those the SLAs and the security aspects. I mean, it's you know, I've said this before, but do you trust the clowns you know or the clowns you don't?
Now, Kim, when someone comes up to you guys and they must ask this question, you know, what happens if the data center where my application is hosted goes away, has a catastrophic failure? Do you have a system whereby it's going to automatically fail over to some other geographic location? How does that work?
Yeah, there are some failure methods, but what I think is most important here is that Amazon pretty much accept anything. We don't. So if you come to us and say we need complete mission critical, then we might as well just turn you down. Because we, you know, there are some things that's out of our control. Exactly as Greg said, they need redundant lines, they need whatever. So in some cases, we simply say, "Well, this is not a solution for you." And being able to do that kind of shields you against a lot of these issues. Of course, we need to make sure that things are running, but we don't want to run into a situation where we can't provide the service that people expect.
I'm not saying that cloud providers don't have this answers, but as any good business says, you know, if you run an accounting system, you have a tape backup that you take off-site and you put in a vault. Why? Because in the worst case, you can go and go to another building, build a new system, and restore that tape, and your accounting system is back in action. If you send your data into the cloud, have you got something equivalent to that process to recover your business from? And that's up to the customer. And the question, my point is that by the time you work that process out, you might as well have not bothered to use the cloud in more than 50% of cases.
Yeah, but you know, Greg, to be fair to the cloud providers, some of those questions aren't being asked in the enterprise. I mean, even with that, I have to tell you that if, like we do, we have this thing called a risk register. And, you know, you look at, and I'm sure, you know, every enterprise, or maybe a lot of them don't, but they have holes that they haven't plugged. And it's not going to make any difference when you move to the cloud. I think the only mistake they make is that they think it doesn't matter when they move to the cloud.
Yeah, a lot of times it's not the IT people that are driving the whole process of migrating some application to the cloud. Someone on the business side who's not really an IT person at all gets this in their head that this is a good idea. Some cloud provider salesperson calls up and says, hey, you can take advantage of this service. It's going to cost X and it's just going to be wonderful. And that's as far as the thinking process goes. They're 90% of the way down the sales contract and someone says, oh, by the way, maybe we should have one of the IT guys take a look at this thing and make sure it's a good idea, at which point it's almost too late to turn the deal down or massage it such that it would actually be secure and resilient. Sure. And all that. So that's definitely.
But we're talking about the long-term future of cloud for hosting all of our services. So we could talk positively about the marvelous value proposition of stacking a rack with, you know, four Cisco UCS chassis and loading them with a 30-to-1 server ratio to get, you know, 1,200 servers in one RU, and the thermal efficiencies and the power efficiencies thereof, and the administrative efficiencies where we reduce the count of, you know, 30 servers per one administrator to 250-to-1 per administrator. These are all things that we know, and yeah, there are efficiencies around those. But let me tell you a story about a company that I had a chat with about some stuff. They've moved some development work into an Amazon instance, which was being charged on a per CPU hour. And somebody was doing some work in it on a Thursday, and they came in on the Monday and realized that they'd actually been setting off a data munge, and on Monday it was still running. And this four-man business has suddenly spent a month's worth of their funding on an Amazon instance that was doing nothing serious. So they then had to stop and spend 2 weeks developing a process that managed their costs, that actually said what's actually being money being spent on per minute, per hour, per day. And if it went beyond a certain limit, it should throw up a threshold alert to say this is the problem. Now, if you are buying a pro rata cloud for your development team. So let's say you've got a team of programmers in the corner who are doing some custom development for your SAP instance, which you've outsourced to SAP. And they start to, you know, SAP has a huge outsourcing division. It's very generously priced for SAP. And you can run all of your SAP instances. So you've got a team of programmers on your site taking the requirements from your business analysts and turning them into a SAP cloud solution for you. And you're paying per SAP hour or per SAP development system, and you've got 30 development instances spread across your programming team. How are you managing those costs? What tools have you got to say, I've got 35, I've got 40 SAP instances now, and I'm paying so much for them. How do I manage that cost? What process have I put in place?
We don't really run our cloud offering that way. Mm-hmm. So that's part of the entire thing, that when this stuff being blah blah cloud is being sold to customers, it's basically on a per pricing that you know that you're gonna have to pay this each month, and you're gonna get whatever you need, of course within the agreement. But if you go beyond that, there are no ramifications on it. You don't get penalized in any way or shape or form. Again, that's one of the benefits of not having the Amazon approach to this thing.
Let's talk for a second about going back to the resiliency and replication between data centers, kind of a presumption that all of that is happening. What, Cam, like when you guys have a customer that signs up, do you have an SLA that says if we have a catastrophic failure here in this site, your application is going to be available either within a certain amount of time or instantaneously at another site, and it'll all be transparent? Or how do you handle that situation?
Yeah, it's stated in the SLA that within, I don't know the exact time, it's going to be swapped over to a secondary location. It's also stated that it won't be instantaneous, but it will be within a pre-set amount of time. So it's in the SLA, and it's one of the things that's actually gone through with the customers, so they are aware of it. And it's one of the risk factors that they're made aware of.
So there is then some sort of, I would guess, like near real-time replication that's going on between one or multiple sites?
Yeah, we have multiple sites. Of course, using VMware and different storage and fiber channel. The different sites are not that far apart. So, you know, it can be up and running pretty fast. Again, you know, if it all depends on the customer. If it's only we provide a mail service for them, this is not an issue. It's not really discussed in that much detail. But if you're moving your entire enterprise to a private cloud, for example, it definitely is.
Can you report back to the users on exactly what sort of how many bytes they've moved, how many compute cycles they've used, anything like that, so they've got some idea of how busy they're keeping the resources that have been allocated to them?
We do have some information that's actually also moved out outside our entire infrastructure. So we partnered up with an external company that actually provides that for us in case the entire, you know, building goes kaput. There are these things being addressed in it. The details I'm not quite sure of.
Mrs. Way, I don't know if you've looked at this at all, or Greg either, but another question that seems to pop up as you outsource these services is, what do you do about user authentication? And let's say it's an application you've moved up into the cloud, but yet you want your users to be able to authenticate back to your own company's Active Directory domain, let's say, or some other sort of meta directory schema that your users need to authenticate against, and there could be a lot of reasons why they'd need to authenticate against a very specific database. Is there a mechanism that is typically available from a cloud provider to do that kind of a thing?
I mean, they should have an API. I mean, that's actually listed as a top threat. I mean, if you've gone to the trouble to have identity management in your organization and you have LDAP groups and, you know, a very tree-like directory structure, and then you go to a cloud provider and they say, oh, well, you have to have a parallel, you know, mechanism, I mean, it sort of defeats the whole purpose. And that API is also a potential threat, you know, a potential risk because, you know, have they written it? Is it in Java? How often, you know, I mean, are they using mod security or something on that web interface? I mean, you've just, it's all the same questions that you have to ask, you know, about your internal enterprise are multiplied times 10, you know, when you move to the cloud, because all of a sudden it's, you know, you don't control it. And it's like probably, I mean, I, you know, I respect the fact that they're not going to tell me every aspect and share every part of their architecture with me, because that would be a security violation. But then, you know, our due diligence requires that we get as much information as possible. So it's like this massive chess game, trying to get information out and them trying to give as little as they have to.
Well, how secure is it? It's secure. I mean, I can't tell you, because then it wouldn't be secure anymore.
Right.
And you, it's very difficult to validate that, right? How can you go in and audit a cloud provider's security when need to know applies, and yet need to know is best practice? There's one other topic about the cloud that I think also needs to be understood, is when things are moved to the cloud, they often move to a, if you're looking at some of the application as a service functions, and applications as a service are classically Google Mail, Gmail. And if you, say, compare Gmail functions to the Exchange servers that we've been using for the last 20 years, for all of the pain and suffering that we go through with building an Exchange server, there are things that we can do at the server side that are very important, such as detecting mails, analyzing emails to see if somebody's saying something that they shouldn't be. You know, if somebody's bullying somebody at work, or if somebody is accusing somebody of being, you know, something wrong, or other human resources issues. If you're a customer of Google and you want to look at people's emails boxes, it's not an easy thing to do. There are certainly no tools to easily bring up dashboards of compliance and validation. You're effectively stuck with the tools that the cloud provider gives you for these application as a service models. Now, the loose term I call this is that ultimately the cloud always looks like public transport compared to owning your own car. And what that means is, if you go to work in the morning and you walk out, you walk down to the end of your street and you catch a bus, and the bus will take you into the city. And you might think that's a very good deal. It's a very cheap way of getting to work, and, you know, it's not too inconvenient. It's not as good as having a car and driving into the city. But let's say you're going across town to visit your grandma, and you have to walk down to the end of your street, catch the bus into the city, then go catch a bus across the city, and then catch a third bus to get to your grandma's house. And then you have to turn around and come back again. So public transport's fine as long as it's going in the direction that you want it to go, as long as it's doing what you want. Where public transport fails is when you're actually trying to get somewhere where the public transport system doesn't cover. And a lot of the cloud services that we see today, you have to make compromises to take them on. So we see a lot of Java hosting is the big fundamental fun thing about the cloud. And we're seeing VMware buying some Java hosting providers, and Oracle's looking at building one as well, so that you can host your own Java applications in the cloud. Which sounds great, except that every Java server that I've ever worked on is highly customized to the task, and they spend time tuning it. Now imagine if you then have to buy a cloud server twice as big as one that would be customized to run your Java application. Is then the benefit of the cloud clearly visible compared to the alternatives? I'm not sure. I regard the cloud as, you know, it's for poor people, people who can't afford a proper computer system. So
I think you can.
If you're not wealthy enough to do it properly, you'll go and get a cloud. So who's using the cloud today? The people using the cloud today are the startups who've got no cash, or the companies who are broke because their businesses are going away and they want to save money by putting stuff in the cloud. So if you put something in the cloud to me today, now this may change as time goes by, you're just poor, and you're going to get a poor service that's not as good as one that you could build yourself if you took the time and the energy to work out how it works.
Well, I got to tell you, for us, we were using an antiquated version of Sun Messaging, and actually we saw that Gmail was an improvement. Because we were using Sun Calendar, we were using Sun Messaging, which are terrible, and then and their web interface, which is terrible. So it was actually a step up for us. We had to rethink our architecture slightly, because then we still have like iron ports doing filtering, you know, but, and we have to be mindful of, okay, we want them to filter through our, you know, we want that to be the MX record and stuff, so it'll filter that. And then, you know, it goes out to Google. But that was like the Google Calendar and Google Mail was actually a step up for us. So, I mean,
well, Kim, I think it was you that told me that mail hosting was one of the success stories of cloud from your perspective.
Yeah, it is. A lot of the first companies were only mail hosted Exchange and whatnot. But I do want to say that, you know, any cloud provider is a compromise. There's always something that, you know, that individual to the company that you want to modify, which you can't in a whatever service provider you use or a cloud provider. So again, the right tool for the job. But you know, in a lot of cases, it's a good enough tool for the job. So if we can offer Exchange to a reasonable price, that's something that they're willing to look into, even if it means that some certain component they had specially made doesn't work. Well, can they live without it? That's what, you know, one of the questions for them is.
I think cloud will work for a lot of people. Don't get me wrong, but all I see is problems and challenges that are probably being ignored in the rush to save cash.
I agree.
Absolutely.
Yeah. You know, and that's not if your business is going down the tubes and you need to save cash so that your workers can still be employed and have jobs, that's fine. But you may well be taking a punt. If you've got a profitable business, you should be carefully considering the long-term impact for the integrity of your business. Mm. Consider what would happen if you outsourced your accounting data and it ends up in China, right? And you're producing products that compete against a Chinese company. And it's just possible. We've seen, you know, we certainly have reason to believe that the Chinese government would, you know, take an opportunity to get access to that data and share it with their government-owned businesses that might want to compete against you.
That goes back to what you were saying earlier, that one of the greatest threats to any security infrastructure are the people that are involved in the banking industry. When I worked there, a lot of the training around security involved making sure that you understood when somebody might be trying to take advantage of you to pull information out of you that they ought not to have, and to be very cautious about that. So you'd go through slides of things that you think would be common sense, but you know, don't just reset someone's password because they asked you to. You need to authenticate who they are and find out that this person really is who they say they are before you go ahead and change their password, for example. And then you add to that people that are purposely going to ignore those policies because someone's going to slip them some money on the side and then share your data out because it's good for them to do that. You've just put a whole lot of your company's information in a place where somebody like that would have access to it. Now what? Is that good for you? Can you deal with that risk?
Again, risk management and assessment. So there's a lot of unanswered questions for all cloud providers, I think. A lot of them we haven't answered yet ourselves. But we try to make those concerns when we try and sell whatever we're trying to sell. Again, one of the technical aspects of it is that we don't want to sell any cloud solution without having a technician along with the sales guy, basically just to make sure that, you know, they don't sell anything that we can't security-wise live up to.
I mean, it is worth noting that the cloud is valuable. It does represent a growth of efficiency in that high density servers collapsed into a single location do mean we get the benefit of scaling out servers. And administratively, we get the power of applying a lot of knowledge in a very small space instead of what we have today, which is a very distributed knowledge base. And we're always looking for software that makes it easier. So the cloud certainly has value, but it also has a lot of weaknesses. There are also other threats to the long-term value of the cloud where servers today use Intel processors, which are hot, heavy, large. They consume large volumes. And so what we're doing is stacking, you know, 30, 40, 50, 75 machines on one server. And yet we are also now starting to see silicon designs that are very, very low powered, maybe 1/100th of the power of an Intel server, which could host 5 or 6 machines. If electronics gets smaller faster, then the efficiency of servers getting bigger and more power resource hungry, we could actually see it get to the point where the actual cost of running a server is as cheap to have it in your house as it is to have it in a big data center in Central America somewhere. So there are long-term goals around this which haven't necessarily been worked out.
That's a pretty good summary. That's a pretty good summary of the discussion that we've had. It's not mature yet. There's a lot of questions worth asking. A lot of that stuff we talked about, whether it's security or resiliency, and it's not a one size fits all. As Kim was pointing out, they're very careful about what services they put where and what customers they think it's a wise thing for them to service and who maybe isn't. So it's not just as simple as call up your cloud provider and let's move to the cloud and everything's going to be great. A lot of smart questions that people should be asking about this. So why don't we call it a show, guys? I think that was a real good discussion.
It's a show.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so. And you know what? I think Greg needs to use his trademark expression here. Should you go to the cloud?
It depends, yeah. I mean, for all the hype about the cloud, I use it. I use Google Mail.
Yeah,
you know, to host my mail because it's the most efficient way to get rid of spam in my mail system. Mm. And I use a number of online services to host. For example, my blog is hosted in the cloud because it's the most efficient way to do it. Mm. Do I keep a local backup of it? You bet. Regularly take a copy and put it. So if I had to, I could recover from a loss of data. Do I keep a copy of my email on my machine? Sure, I do. I use IMAP and everything that's up there is down on my machine. That's how I mitigate that risk.
Well, Kim Petersen, thank you very much for joining us, sir, all the way from Denmark. And can people find you on Twitter? Do you have a blog? How could folks follow you, keep in touch?
Yeah, I blog once in a while on packet-forwarding.net or at Twitter at kpjungle.
Great. And you got any big exciting projects you're working on this week?
Not really. I'm on my vacation, so I'm just trying to chill out and enjoy the sun that shines at least today.
So Packet Pushers podcast is vacation for Kim Petersen. Wow. All right. That's pretty cool.
How cool is that?
Not cool.
And Mrs. Y, of course, you are deeply secretive and anonymous. And but what are you going to be working on this week?
Wherever DBAs complain about the network being down and it's actually a bad TNS names file, whenever a sysadmin
close.
The network is slow and it's actually a bad net mask,
that's
where Mrs. Y, a.k.a. Network Security Princess, will be.
Awesome. And Greg, what about this? You heading back to your screens after we stop recording here?
I am, and even though it is 9:30 at night, I still have 3 hours to go because my training course is based in America. I'm also starting to ramp up the preparations for Network Field Day later this year, which is going to be very exciting, talking to vendors and communicating with them around how to get involved. And, of course, if you are a vendor and you want to be involved in talking to the pushers in person and being part of the Tech Field Day experience and getting your company in front of a very large audience, get in contact with me.
And, of course, I am Ethan Banks. You can follow me on Twitter at EC Banks or check out Google Plus. I am up there as well where I'm doing more stuff because it's better for discussion up on Google Plus. And, of course, follow the Packet Pushers on Twitter, at Packet Pushers. Email us, packetpushers@gmail.com. Hey, apparently Packet Pushers uses the cloud, too. And also Packet Pushers up on G+ as well. We love to hear from you. It's really great when you let us know what you think of the shows, any questions that you have. It gives us ideas for new shows. And, of course, we wouldn't turn our nose up at any financial remuneration you'd be interested in passing along. So you can head on up to packetpushers.net, hit the donate button, and we'd really, really and truly appreciate that. It does cost money and, of course, time to put the shows on. That's the show for this week. Everybody have a good week, and we will see you next time.